Hello everyone, my name is Karen Smith. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department here. Welcome to the fifth roundtable in the series of roundtables that we're doing on EU foreign policy up to Lisbon, which has been kindly sponsored by the European Commission John Monnet program. I think that's the first time we've remembered to put that in, first of all, so very important to get that in. Anyway, this time we're doing the roundtable is going to be on influencing the EU foreign policy process. And we've got three people here who come from NGOs based in Brussels. And so what I wanted for us to get an understanding of is the extent to which they feel they can influence the EU foreign policy process. So I asked them to address questions such as, what is the influence of NGOs and think tanks on EU foreign policy making? Which actors in Brussels are the most receptive to NGO messages? Is the role of NGOs and think tanks in the EU policymaking process similar to that of the US or not? And then has the implementation of the Lisbon Treaty changed anything? Made life more difficult? Made life easier? I have a feeling it might be making life more difficult, but we'll wait for our speakers to let us know what their views are on this. And I'll introduce them in the order that they will speak. First off is a graduate, an MSc graduate of the International Relations Department, Chiara Castaldi, who's a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group. What I've asked each of them also to do is say a brief word about their particular NGO as well, so they can let us know what they're doing. Then we will have Catherine Willard, who is the executive, the director of the European Peace Building Liaison Office, which is an umbrella organization. Again, she'll say a few words about that. And then finally, a face quite familiar to Alice, because she's done some teaching here before, is Heather Graba, who is the director of the Open Society Institute in Brussels. She was also in the office of Olli Rehn when he was the European Commissioner on Enlargement. So she's seen things from outside and from inside. So what I've done is to ask each of them to speak about 10, 15 minutes, addressing some of those questions, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience.
Thanks a lot for inviting me to this table. I'm really pleased to be here. As it has been said, my position is senior analyst, EU advocacy and research at the International Crisis Group. I'm based in Brussels, and my, let's say, conflict area is basically Brussels. So this is my field of expertise. I don't know how familiar you are with the International Crisis Group, but Crisis Group is a non-profit NGO, which is committed to work to prevent and to resolve deadly conflict. ICG work is basically based on three pillars which are combined and linked to each other. We are based with field-based analysis, but basically the aim of it is to identify the problem on the ground. We have field offices everywhere in the various continents and in the various zones of conflict. The second pillar is to produce policy prescription to domestic actors as well as international actors. And that in practice means identify the appropriate response to the problem. And then the third pillar, which is the one that we are going to talk about today, is high level advocacy. The way we understand the focus of the International Crisis Group is in terms of mobilizing the political will of international decision makers. Political will is often the main obstacle to take political action. So what we want to achieve through our work and through the production of our reports and the drafting of our recommendation is a policy shift by international actors or by domestic actors, according to the country that we're working on. We don't work on thematic issues, we focus on specific conflict. As I said, I'm working in Brussels in the EU advocacy team, which is composed by three people, and we cover the EU institution as well as member states. which means not just the mistakes in Brussels, but the mistakes in the countries. And we try to push the recommendations that are proposed by our field staff, but we also feed the information about the EU policy to our colleagues in the field. In terms of advocacy work, I see advocacy work as a process. It's a process which is composed of various elements. It's about building contacts, it's about building trust relationship with the target audience and stakeholders. It's about being able to produce clear messages based, in our case, on sound analysis, independent analysis on the ground. It's about knowing very well the decision-making process in a way that it's possible to identify who are the key actors and what are the possible entry points. I also think another important element of advocacy work is to understand the timeline of events and the sequencing of decision-making. This is already a challenging task because it requires a lot of gathering information, networking, knowledge about decision-making procedures, and is even more challenging if we consider the EU as a target of advocacy. And this is because the EU is not like a member state. In the EU context, we still have the duality of member states carry out their bilateral foreign policy and member states deciding on the basis of their interest when to carry out common foreign policy within the EU framework. So we work in a framework which is not clear cut, as it could be with a state that you know the national interest, you know the foreign policy, you know the priorities, you know what is the strategic thinking behind a foreign policy of a state. So the EU context is very complex. The EU machinery is complex. There are various institutions. As I said, there are the member states, there are the permanent representation of the member states, but there are also the member states in the capitals. It's not just about various actors, but it's also about the competition among these actors. And this is also a competition that exists within the EU institution, within the Commission, and the now recently established External Action Service, but also with the European Parliament as well. And there is also a situation in which you don't have, as I said, in the case of our nation state, a clear identification of an interest. There is no defined clear interest. And there is also a sort of lack of leadership and ownership also on the side of the member states of the EU foreign policy. The Lisbon Treaty, and in particular the creation of the External Action Service, was the expectation, and what everyone was expecting, was that the EU would become a united actor, a coherent actor, the united voice in foreign policy. And also that the External Action Service was meant to develop in the foreign service of the EU. And this was, at least on paper, partly achieved by the idea of creating a single geographical desk officer, bringing together conflict prevention and crisis management response structure, trying to include development policy and enlargement policy within the scope of the External Action Service, creating the post of the High Representative Vice President of the Commission, giving to the High Representative a right of initiative in foreign policy, which was not the case with Solana, and also including member states diplomats as part of the system. Another important change was the creation of the permanent position of the chairs of the Geographical and Thematic Working Group of the Council, but also of the permanent chair of the Political and Security Committee. this was on paper, what is happening in practice, it doesn't really, it's not really a streamline of the EU foreign policy decision making. The creation of the External Action Service has not solved the problem of having multiple decision making centers in EU foreign policy. Still, we have the European Commission, we have the External Action Service, we have the member states, we have also what we can define as an unintended consequence of the Lisbon Treaty, which is the fact that not having a presidency, which was the 6 months presidency, which was in any case a driving force of the EU foreign policy making, has become problematic because it has not been replaced by anything else. Now there is a sort of vacuum. Before, with the 6 months presidency, despite the fact that the presidency was linked to the national interest of that specific country and was just for 6 months, was giving anyway a driving force to the new foreign policy making. This is not the case anymore. And the problem is because on one side, the External Action Service has not been able yet to take on this task. And this could be potentially done by the permanent chairs of the EPSC and the permanent chairs of the Council of Europe. But also because there is a lack of leadership from the top and a lack of sense of ownership and buy-in by the member states on the other side. Given this, this context, the question is how to do advocacy and how ICG advocacy in particular has changed during the last 2 years. I have to say that in terms of targets, ICG targets have always been member states. The difference between the pre-Lisbon period and the post-Lisbon period is that before ICG was creating a very strong relationship with the countries within the presidency. Now it's not the case. Now we maintain high-level meetings with all the member states in the capitals as well as in Brussels, but we don't have a specific relationship with the presidency anymore. We are trying to, and this is what we have been done in the last 2 years, to strengthen and to build the contacts with the senior management team of the External Action Service, to with the managing directors of the various geographical departments, and but also at more working level with the various desk offices. In terms of our targets and strategy with the target in relation to identify the right targets, we are especially recently sort of thinking whether it might make more sense to not just to focus on member states in Brussels, but to refocus our advocacy at the capitals level. And this is because it always looks like that foreign policy decisions are taken by member states more in the various coalition among themselves, and then going back to the EU framework more for a sort of a blessing or endorsement by the EU. So we are trying to coordinate what we do at capital level with what we do at Brussels level in a much more consistent way. We also, and this is because of the relation between the External Action Service and the Commission, which is not clear in terms of division of labor, especially in relation to development policy and to the enlargement policy, we are also rebuilding contacts with the Commission because at the operational level, it's still not very clear who is actually taking a decision about development policy and about enlargement policy. In relation with the European Parliament, we always had a very good working relation. The European Parliament could be a good ally. It's also true that the European Parliament doesn't have any role in foreign policy decision making, but it could be a good ally in terms of raising awareness on a specific issue. How do we do advocacy? As I said, we are only training based in Brussels, but our also pointed out by our field staff that constantly and systematically comes to Europe and goes to the various capitals in Europe. We participate in two bilateral meetings as well as the at all levels, so from the political and security committee ambassador to the working level of the desk officer in the external action service. We do formal and informal advocacy. It's important to say that often also advocacy which is done behind closed doors could be very, very effective, it's not mainly known, but it could have potentially a significant impact. In terms of, we use our reports in terms of recommendation and policy lines, but it's also true that, especially recently, we have started to develop more targeted memos or briefings that we target specifically to the EU when we know that a specific decision is going to be taking place. With the recommendation that are targeted and in a way feasible for the EU to be taken on board. I think that timing is actually one of the key issues of our advocacy work. Especially because, as I said, we focus on country-specific work. So it's important for us to know the various geographical council working group or at the level of the QC when a country is going to be discussed and what kind of discussion is going to take place. Because in that way we can reach out to the ambassador and bilateral meetings, send our reports and be more effective in our advocacy. In terms of impact, it's quite difficult to measure impact, especially being a conflict prevention organization. And I think this is a challenge for any peacebuilding conflict prevention organization. It's difficult to really to measure the impact and also to clarify whether it's just because ICG recommended a specific plan of action or whether it's also because other organizations are pushing the same plan of action. There are too many factors in the process to be able to really to find a causal link. However, I have to say that there are cases where it was clear that an ICG position has been taken on board by the EU, or at least our analysis helped the EU to be more informed and to feed and to shape the debate among the EU member states. One example that I can give is a very recent one, is our work on Zimbabwe, which in a way I think is a significant example because it shows how advocacy is a process. It's not just a meeting that you have pushing for a specific recommendation. It's about the credibility of your organization. It's about meeting and maintaining contacts with the people working in that specific country. It's about building trust with the officials from the outside. And this is what happened in the case of Zimbabwe. We started a meeting already in May last year, regularly with our analysts coming from the field, briefing them on the situation in Zimbabwe, presenting our reports and our recommendations. And then when we knew that the EU was going to reassess its policy in terms of restrictive measure and active measure in the case of Zimbabwe, we were able to produce a targeted memo to the EU institution and to the member states proposing our recommendation for the way ahead for the EU. And some of these recommendations were taken on board. And that was important because we managed to time our report and our briefing exactly at the right time where the discussion in Brussels was taking place. And this is not always possible. And this is also a challenge because the agendas of the member states and the agenda of the EU is difficult to gather information about the agenda of the EU and the agenda of the member states, and it changes quite frequently. One of the innovations of the Lisbon Treaty was the creation of this permanent chair for the Political and Security Committee and for the stronger in setting the agenda of the member states and do a planning that goes beyond the 1 month or 2 months agendas, which was the case with the presidency before. I think I will stop here.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for Catherine.
Great. Thank you. My name is Catherine Woolard. I'm, as Karen said, I'm the director of ECPLO, the European Peacebuilding Liaison Office. I'm going to address the four questions that we've been asked to address, starting with what is the influence of NGOs on the European Union foreign policy-making processes. I will give a few examples of influence, but then talk about what makes us more influential, and then on the other side, what are the obstacles to having influence? And firstly, an obvious declaration of interest that my job and my salary depends on us having influence. So, of course, I would claim that we do have some influence. My conclusion thinking about this question was really that NGOs have some influence, but not enough. And I'll explain right at the end what I mean by that cryptic assertion. Now, we're a network of 30 organisations and we work on conflict prevention and peace building. Our objective is to make the European Union more active and more effective at building peace and preventing conflict. And I mention that also because in a sense we have also built-in pro-Europeanism, I think, in the sense that we want the EU to be more active and effective. And I realise this, certainly when you're working in Brussels, the answer quite often seems to be more Europe, more integration. I think to some extent we all go native, as was said once of a UK commissioner who was recalled, we're going native. Now, what do? We develop common positions and then we advocate for them. And we use the general advocacy techniques that Chiara describes. Our focus is on external affairs broadly, not just on common foreign and security policy. And I think this is important, and if I may provocatively throw in a criticism of a lot of the academic work on the EU, I think there's over-analysis of CFSP. If we look at the scope that the EU has for influence, there are other areas of external affairs policy there that I think demonstrate far more the EU to be more powerful than CFSP. A few examples of policies that we're working on and the small influence that we've had. One of our policy objectives is to bring peace building into the institutions and structures of the EU. In the last couple of years, we've focused on the External Action Service, inevitably. We put out a paper in 2010 called A Peace Building Strategy for the European External Action Service. And that was a typical policy paper that we would do. It was, I think, 6-7 pages. It contained 43 recommendations, somebody counted. One of the criticisms often of NGOs is that we put in too many and unrealistic recommendations. But if we look back now, a number of those recommendations have been realised, have been achieved. Now, that's not, of course, just because of our work. As Chiara says, to trace impact of one actor is extremely difficult. But for instance, one thing we campaigned for, even before this particular paper, but certainly was a headline there, was a division, a unit within the External Action Service working on peace building and conflict prevention. And there is this division. The Division for Conflict Prevention, Peacebuilding and Mediation, which is being built up. And our argument was that there needed to be this team to drive forward work on this issue. And in fact, Baroness Ashton strongly resisted the creation of this division. And part of our strategy was to build alliances with other actors who supported this. In particular, there were a number of MEPs that were very active pushing for this, and using, actually quite creatively, using the power of Parliament which is, as I'm sure most of you know, not extensive in external affairs. And there are also some member states who supported this objective. And a few other examples. One of our objectives is to get more funding for peace building. That doesn't necessarily mean funding for us and for our members, but for the EU to be putting more resources into peace building. And this led in part to the creation of the Peace Building Partnership, which is a pot of money specifically for peace building action. Some of which goes to the UN, some to member states, some to NGOs. And I think before Lisbon, a lot of our advocacy targeting the Commission looked at funding issues and legal changes. And that was partly because of the Commission's own self-definition as technical, not political. So one of the shifts has been that we focus less or trying to affect those kind of changes. And certainly now, if you engage with the Commission, there is a recognition that it has a political role, which I think is an interesting shift. Final point, just as an example of another policy area, we look at development assistance. We argue for the integration of peace building and development assistance. And I think there is a process of modernising and reforming EU development assistance taking place. And this is something that we've contributed to in part. We can say more if that's of interest in the discussion. Now, the two points I wanted to look at were how to have more of an influence, what leads to an NGO being influential on EU policy, and then on the other side, what are the obstacles and constraints? I'll just sort of do this as a list, and then if it's of interest, we can discuss in more detail. The first point, I think, is quality of written work and analysis. And certainly when I started this job three and a half years ago, it was my sort of strategy to improve the quality of the work that EPPO was doing in order to get access to policymakers. And now I sound really immodest, but I think that has worked a huge amount. And I think without that quality written analysis, you're not taken seriously, you're not credible. But in addition, how you then present that in public meetings, of course, is part of the quality of your analysis and output. But what does it mean to produce quality analysis in an EU context? I think it has to be things that are very detailed, to some extent technical, and that show a clear understanding of EU policymaking, the role of different institutions, where recommendations are very specifically targeted, and where you also demonstrate understanding of legal, bureaucratic, and political constraints. So, for instance, one thing that we try not to do is come out with a sort of vague recommendation like the EU needs to support cooperation with NGOs. The EU needs one I read recently, the EU needs to support local ownership in Yemen. I mean, to me this is a meaningless thing. Even if you say the EU should do something, I find that a meaningless recommendation to make. And it's something that I would think policymakers would just dismiss as you not knowing your job. What else helps? Chiara mentioned the competition between institutions, but understanding the relationship between the institutions and using it is also something that we do a lot. I think collective action is important, but then I manage a network, so I would say that. Not everybody would agree. But we notice that policymakers like the fact that we have a range of expertise that we can draw on, and that if we have a meeting, because we have 30 members, there may be a variety of different views and ideas there. And it also means they can liaise with one NGO interlocutor and not 30. The management of the relationship itself with policymakers, I think, is very important, and trying to design constructive and fruitful discussions and dialogue so that you don't set up discussions where basically NGOs come in and shout at policymakers, which actually does happen all the time. But you know, personally, I don't want to sit in that discussion, so I'm sure they don't. And yet at the same time, people have to be, of course, people are allowed to be critical, but how do you manage that? into turn it into something constructive. And building alliances, I mentioned, with different institutions at different points in time, and understanding the sort of political culture in Brussels. For instance, for me to go and work in Geneva or Addis, international advocacy environments, I wouldn't know where to start, because the whole political culture would be something very different. What strategies you develop, how you engage with policymakers. On the other side, what are the obstacles and what limits our influence? On the one hand, there are powerful, so this sounds like, starts to sound like conspiracy theory, there are powerful enemies who have far more resources than we do. And so one of the issues that we work on, something like the arms trade, there's no way we have even 1/1000th of the resources that the arms industry has in order to try and influence EU policy and also to pay lobbyists on their behalf to influence EU policy. And you can see that all over the place. I mean, I see reports that come out of the European Parliament where there are great chunks that have been written by lobbyists for the arms industry. If you see the outcomes policy decisions, research funding, why does 15% of EU research funding go to defence companies? Because they have the power to lobby and convince the EU policymakers that their research should be supported. Other constraints, the lack of interest and understanding of the general wider public, I think is clearly a problem. It's a problem for the issue that we work on. We try to use the idea of the European Union itself as a peace project, as something that we bring into our advocacy, but I'm not sure how many people in the European populations actually still believe in that idea or understand the history of the EU. I mean, certainly in this country, probably not so many. Another issue that sort of relates to that, the limited resources available for external affairs. If we look at the EU's own budget, still the 40% spending on common agricultural policy, 4% on external affairs. Quite often we see the pattern of the EU adopting policy that it doesn't have the resources to implement. And then you have teams of people working on these issues who are under-resourced and who are also constrained by bureaucracy, which absorbs time and energy on the part of officials. Final points in terms of constraints. Sometimes we see a sort of scepticism of many EU policymakers towards working with NGOs. I think many of them agree in principle with the idea of participation of civil society as representative of the wider public in EU policymaking. And there are a number of laws, I mean regulations on this, but in practice, a lot of them are very sceptical because from experience, it's not necessarily worth their time to engage with NGOs. And I think that comes partly because of the sheer number of NGOs working in Brussels, the competition between them, and in some cases, I have to say, the poor quality of work or discussion with them. Other constraints, I'm just looking at what I've noted. Let's move on. The final points I was asked to address, which EU actors are most receptive to NGOs? I think it depends who you are as an NGO. I mean, I can only talk from our side as EPPO. Firstly, most receptive, officials and divisions and units that deal with thematic issues. So who work on peace building, conflict prevention, human rights, democratisation, development policy assistance broadly, governance. We find them far more open than those who work on geographic and regional issues. But then that's partly because our work is focused on those thematic topics anyway. I think Chiara might find the opposite because they focus on specific conflicts. European Parliament, many MEPs are very open, but then that raises the question, how many do you actually want to be associated with? And then the second question, what power do they actually have? And in external affairs, again, as you know, in certain respects it's limited. We try to use the budget power, for instance. Member states, it varies according to the member state and to the personality of individual diplomats. We have just done an analysis of member states looking at different factors. Firstly, sympathy with our agenda. Are they interested in peace building? Secondly, their support for European action, because this is what we're arguing for. And then thirdly, their power to influence EU policy making, which depends on their size, but also on the calibre of their diplomatic corps, and also on their interest in putting forward an agenda. So, for instance, if we took that analysis, France, you would say support for European action, absolutely. Power within EU policy making, yes, definitely, because of the size and the calibre of staff in Brussels seconded and representing France. Sympathy with our agenda, no, zero. France pushing very strongly for militarisation of CFSP under this government, very limited interest in the ideas that we're putting forward about foreign policy and a less traditional approach to diplomacy. I mean, pure realism from KDLC all the way, which doesn't really meet with the peace-building agenda. UK, sympathy with our agenda, yes. I mean, if you look at building stability overseas, recent UK policy, a lot of the ideas on preventive action, building long-term peace have been adopted. Problem, support for European action, not really. Let's look at the speeches of Hague where saying that Europe shouldn't even have a diplomatic service. Has he read the Lisbon Treaty? And then just to conclude on member states, you have others who, we use the expression punch above their weight. So here we would mention Finland, Sweden, the Netherlands, for instance, strong on peace-building issues, strong support for European action, power, even though they're relatively small member states. So they would be key targets. Final point, the question we were asked to look at was, is the role of NGOs in EU policymaking similar to NGOs' role at member state level? And I think this follows from those points there. It depends, of course, on the member state. I think when you look at, I personally have lived and worked and done advocacy in five different member states, and the political culture is so different from one member state to another. You know, the difference between Spain and Finland for an NGO trying to influence policy, but also for the NGO scene itself. I mean, who is part of civil society varies. And we see this in terms, I mean, just to give examples of where we see this varies. We have dialogue meetings on EU policy at member state level, and this is partly part of our advocacy strategy. Member states have a key role in EU decision making. We need to take the debate into capital cities. We've had meetings in Finland, Romania, France, Netherlands, and Spain next. And the difference in those meetings, even though we're discussing more or less the same issue, is huge. And even in some really basic, sort of seemingly superficial things. So in Finland, it's extremely relaxed. We're all sitting, not quite in a circle, but nearly, high-level representatives of the Finnish government there. The NGO people know everybody, small country situation. Very high level of understanding of EU policy, high level of debate, strong commitment to peace building agenda, serious discussion. Meeting in France, we're in a ballroom, the speakers are on a stage, it's incredibly formal, the focus is on CFSP, little interest in anything else. We have some really quite tense discussions on the future of EU policymaking. A lot of criticism of the lack of leadership of Ashton, so on. So, you know, just to say sort of superficial differences, but there is a more serious point behind that, that the role of NGOs, I think, in the different member states is very different anyway. We might see this then reflected at Brussels level. Another example, I was at a briefing on ULEX, the CSDP mission in Kosovo. One of the things we were arguing was that the ULEX mission should have a functioning relationship with civil society in Kosovo. But basically, because it has executive mandate, part of its accountability structure should be accountability to the population of Kosovo, where it's operating. Some member states agree with this completely. There were a number of member states in the room who thought this was an absolutely absurd idea, that they didn't know what we were talking about. And really, the whole idea of NGOs being part of a state-building process, having a role in accountability, was alien. And again, you'll see that played out across development policy and external affairs. So to conclude, so that's my trick when I speak too much, is to keep saying I'm concluding. I was also asked to look at implementation of the Lisbon Treaty, but I think Heather's going to look at the differences that have resulted from Lisbon. It changes to some extent, it changes targets. So for instance, the fact that the European Parliament has a larger role means that it becomes more important. The fact that national parliaments finally do have a role means that we're looking, for instance, at committees in national parliaments and trying to use them to monitor the EU, or shall I say, to push our agenda within the EU. The change in the presidency has, the loss of the strength of the presidency, I think, has been significant. For this issue, conflict prevention and peace building, many of the major policy developments came from presidencies. So there is a problem with the lack of presidencies. Everybody will criticise forever Ashton and her leadership. I'm not going to do that myself, not that we would disagree, but I think we also need time to see if the service is going to be able to provide the leadership and develop the strategies that member states want it to. So for instance, in a recent discussion actually that Chiara and I were at with one of the member state ambassadors, I asked explicitly, what do member states need to unite behind the EU? In order, for instance, in, I don't know, anywhere from Sudan to Egypt, what would you need to be uniting behind the EU rather than acting bilaterally? And the clear answer is timely and high quality ideas and strategies from the service. If this comes in, then member states are willing to put aside their own ideas, their own bilateral activity, and work within a collective EU framework. And this is something we would argue for, just because it's more realistic when you look at the power that Europe actually has in the world. In order to actually have an impact in conflict-affected countries, collective action makes sense. So I started by saying that NGOs have some influence, but not enough. And when I say not enough, I think it's not enough when we look at the role of non-state actors now generally in politics and in the world. I mean, the power, the state, as all of you good IR students will know, is decreasingly important. If we look at conflict, the issue we work on, both causing conflict and resolving conflict is increasingly done by non-state actors. And for that reason, that sort of gives the legitimacy for NGOs to be involved in policy making. So I think there is some influence from non-state actors, but it's not commensurate with the power that non-state actors have outside policy making. And I think if we look at traditional political actors, they become less and less legitimate, particularly political parties. And again, we could argue that NGOs however criticised they may be, are sometimes more representative than traditional political actors, and again, don't have the role in policy making that reflects that.
Great, thanks very much. Right, thanks. I'll be relatively brief because we won't have much time for discussion, and it would be interesting to have the interaction with you all. I'm just going to combine what I say to the impact of the Lisbon Treaty. I was working in the Commission when the Lisbon Treaty final arrangements were being drawn up, and I was working on the enlargement portfolio where there was a clear need for consolidation of structures because you had the Council working on it, you had the Commission working on it, you had the delegations which were answerable to the Commission but in practice had to deal with the Council. There was ESDP at that point, as well as CFSP, as well as Community Action. It was really messy. And I was one of the greatest proponents of, you know, let's merge it all, let's have a common structure, let's have single desks for each country. I was even in favour of putting DG enlargement into the External Action Service. And that was just from experience of actually trying to get things done, trying to get, for example, the EULEC set up, trying to get the EU's policy on Balkans to work effectively. So I entered it, this whole period in, with quite a lot of enthusiasm and hope that it was the impact of the Lisbon Treaty would be a better common basis for decision making, whereby member states would reach more unified, more common foreign policy positions, because they would be getting, for one thing, common sources of analysis. For example, political reporting from delegations that was at least as good quality as that from the best member states, maybe better if it was collective. Also the idea that you would have more high-quality officials because you'd have a larger pool to draw from, because you have member states diplomats as well as commission officials, and also just the idea that we would spend an awful lot less time with everybody running around duplicating what everybody else was doing. It all seems terribly logical. Now, it hasn't quite worked out like that. And in a way, the very easy target is Catherine Ashton, is Baroness Ashton, because it's very easy to take pot shots at the head of the service, and also because she doesn't come from a foreign policy background, and there are all kinds of problems. I think, personally, that Talleyrand himself, and indeed Bismarck, would not have been able to make the structure work properly. And that the member states actually bear a lot of responsibility for having undermined the service and having not given it the resources, the political space, or indeed the unity of structure particularly the resources and the political space that it needs. And I think the Commission bears a lot of blame for not giving it the structure and the administrative setup that would have made it work properly. The Commission has gone into the most extraordinary institutional turf battle I've ever seen on this subject. And what I would really recommend to you all is to read a paper that's just come out that Carnegie Europe has just produced. It's on their website, you can download the PDF, by Stefan Lehner, who worked on the Balkans and other issues with Javier Solana for a decade. So he really knows this stuff in detail and was another person who very much wanted to be set up. He's just retired and he's written an excellent analysis of why, what are the structural problems and why the service is not working. He also eschews the temptation just to take pot shots at Ashton and actually looks at how would you make it work properly and some really excellent policy recommendations. And that also, by the way, reinforces some of the points that Chiara and that Catherine have been making, that really high quality analysis from outside the system can have a big impact, because people in the system, they know often perfectly well what the problems are. It's not because they're stupid or ill-informed that they are not producing better policy, it's because they're very constrained. And in fact, one of the most important roles that think tanks in particular can play, as well as NGOs, but especially think tanks, is by publishing analysis, making publicly available analysis that all the insiders know, but which is not available in the political domain, and it's not putting pressure on the member states. So I would really recommend looking at these structural issues, which journalists on the whole are not doing. There's, you just see more and more pieces about Ashton, and if it was only, if it had only been Carl Bildt, if it had only been William Hague. I really think that you need to look at the structure. Because, you know, she's done 2.5 years, she's halfway through her mandate, she's going to be gone in 2.5 years, and problems will remain. So let's look at that. Now, just in terms of the impact of Lisbon, I'll give you a quick list of what impact it's actually had. So, obviously, there's the setting up of the External Action Service. What has happened is, instead of a streamlining and a consolidation of foreign policy making structures and actors, in fact, there are more actors and more structures to influence. But that doesn't necessarily mean that NGOs and think tanks have more influence. It just means we run around a lot more.
Yeah.
It just means we have to go and lobby more people. It creates more work, and you can't be quite sure who's ever really in charge. Sometimes you know, but sometimes you don't. So this proliferation of desks and people with some responsibility somehow for the policy creates a very, very complicated environment. Basically you've got, for example, DG Development, or DevCo as it's now known, in the Commission, is creating desks that parallel those in the External Action Service. You have DG Enlargement, which has desks, and that was, to be fair, was part of the original setup, these work created in addition, which are again paralleling the External Action Service. So on Turkey, absolutely key foreign policy issue for the EU, with all kinds of things going on, you've got a very competent and quite large unit in DG Enlargement, which is responsible for negotiations. But of course, the negotiations aren't happening, so what are they going to do? They've got to work on everything else as well. Then you've got a Turkey unit in the External Action Service with some competent people, some of whom are working in the council, some from member states, which are more or less doing the same kind of work because there isn't anything else to do except to look at foreign policy, structured dialogue, and issues like that. Then you've got the aid, the EPA side of things, which is also run from the Commission, but which is part of, in fact, a wider EPA unit, which is run basically within Enlarge but not within the Turkey unit, and part of the people are, in fact, in DG Home, because that's how they run the Justice and Affairs projects, which are very important in Turkey, rule of law issues and border control and this kind of thing. Then in addition to that, of course, you then have the Enlargement Working Group in the Council, which was there before, but where you've got different connections. Some of them talk more to the External Action Service, some of them talk more to the Commission. And then you've got Parliament, you've got the Joint Parliamentary Committee, and you've got people who kind of do enlargement, and you've got people who do foreign policy. So you've got this huge range of actors, and at least there you don't have DevCo. If you're dealing with Africa, you've got the External Action Service, and you've got DevCo, and then you've got bits of trade, and you've got bits of agriculture, and you've got bits of home. So it's actually very complicated, and the fact that the Commission has kind of distanced itself from the External Action Service and cast adrift the Commission officials who are now working in the External Action Service has created a certain amount of bad blood, actually. The relations are not great. Plus the fact that the people in the delegations also don't have the capacity to go back into the Commission structures, so their careers are affected by this. While the member state officials who come into the External Action Service don't necessarily aren't going to be in for the rest of their careers because they can only serve two terms. So what you have is a lot of people who have a partial commitment to making it work. Now, that you can use if you are an NGO or a think tank to your advantage, because one of the very powerful techniques you can use, and you know, Chiara and Catherine both talked about the classic NGO approach, the classic NGO think tank approaches of doing analysis, explaining the problems, and making policy recommendations, and also the high moral tone, the normative impact, reminding people of their stated commitments, pointing to the inconsistencies, pointing out where the EU is not doing what it said it was going to do. It's not, you know, Karen also plays this role, academics also have this role. But there's another way of, there are two other very important methods of influencing policy, one of which is to bring evidence from the ground, something that Crisis Group also does very strongly, and EPO does, particularly in terms of conflict, and the Open Society Foundations do a great deal between quarter foundations, which is bringing evidence that the delegations are unable to bring to Brussels. Delegations very rarely get outside of the capitals, and they have diplomatic relationships, and they usually talk to the regime. So, for example, after the Arab Spring, when the EU officials, member state officials, really, really needed to know about civil society, they needed to know about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They needed to know what is this Ennahda thing that's emerging in Tunisia. And they had zero analysis. And in fact, it was NGOs and think tanks that were able to say, well, actually, and academics as well, we've been studying the Muslim Brotherhood. Here is what we can tell you about them. Here is what civil society looks like in these countries. You know, and from outside Cairo and Tunis as well. This is what it looks like, you know, in Alexandria, for example. So this thing of bringing information from the ground that they don't have is very important. And in this very fragmented policy environment where people are getting different reports from different areas, that can be very powerful. And then the last one is working with informal alliances. So finding allies within the system to work with, often informing them of what their colleagues, supposedly, are doing, can be very powerful as well. And with the proliferation of actors and the fact that so many people are really quite unsure about where their careers are going and therefore are pretty demotivated, that's a really powerful tool at the moment. It's very important to go and talk to people about policy issues and make them feel that they, in their 3 years they've got left or their kind of short-term temporary office, they might be able to do something, and showing them the opportunities, because they're not necessarily building their careers in the service, sorry to say. So this is another important way in which Lisbon has changed the opportunities for NGOs and think tanks. Now, I'd just like to mention briefly to you the enormous impact of two other things that have happened since Lisbon started being implemented. One is the Euro crisis, and the other one is the Arab Spring. Because this was never intended by the creators of Lisbon. They didn't realize what was going to happen. So the impact of the Euro crisis is very profound on foreign policy. It's profound in political terms, it's profound in terms of resources, and it's also profound in terms of disconnection between policies. So it's important in terms of foreign policy broadly, because frankly there's just less concern and interest among member state governments. There's much less political attention to foreign policy across the board. Everybody is so worried and spending so much time trying to bail out economies, stop them going bankrupt and save the whole project, that it's really quite hard to get foreign policy to the level of the European Council. You know, if you look at the debates about Syria, for example, rather important, Libya, they're kind of in the 5 minutes after they've dealt with the latest Greek debt restructuring package. It's pretty difficult. So that means sometimes the debates are more technocratic. Often it means that, and I notice this very much from the point of view of my organisation, which stands for the Open Society, which promotes human rights and democracy, very transparency and accountability in foreign policy, it's very hard to get them to listen to those issues because they're busy worrying about commercial interests and they're just not paying that much attention. You don't get into the fine details of the policy. It's all about what do we just have to do to get through till next week. The second way in which this is actually exacerbating a longer term trend is that foreign ministries are just becoming less important. They have less weight in their own governments. This is even the case in a large member state like Germany, and I'm not saying this is just a personal impression, this is something I've talked about with great seriousness with German foreign ministry officials and indeed with other member states as well. That basically, it used to be that the foreign minister was the number two in the government after the prime minister. You know, in a German, typical German grand coalition, you'd have the chancellor, and then the second job in the government would go to the coalition partner, and that's the case in the current German coalition, it's Westerwelle. But in most governments now, that position would be finance ministry. In fact, I would say mostly the pecking order in terms of political terms is prime minister, finance minister, interior minister, then maybe actually economy, and then foreign policy. The foreign minister just doesn't have that weight in the cabinet, and the foreign ministry doesn't have that weight in the system, and this matters hugely because the substance of EU external action, the actual foreign policy, is mostly made up of other policies. It's mostly issues that are the preserve of, the responsibility of, and under the control of the finance ministry, the interior ministry, the trade ministry, the economy ministry, even agriculture. And the foreign ministry is essentially just a convener and a coordinator of the governmental position. And that means it's extremely hard for a foreign ministry to overcome the objections or concerns of others. We've seen this in, for example, visa policy. Visas are a very powerful foreign policy instrument because they're something that other countries really want from the EU. Huge leverage. But if you can't persuade the interior ministry to lift the visa requirement, you can't use that thing. You see this also with the Arab Spring. How hard was it to accept Moroccan tomatoes, Tunisian oranges, Egyptian cotton, under any kind of preferential treatment in order to give those economies a boost? Almost impossible. Moldovan wine is another example of this. Very, very hard to get the agriculture and the trade preferences changed. Very, very hard to get also finance ministries to allow resources. We're now trying to do foreign policy in the age of austerity. That's a very different thing. So if you think about what before Lisbon were the main instruments of the EU, you had Solana doing the diplomacy, you know, the silver tongue and the huggy mumble, this was the Solana method, and you had that divided from the money, which was in the hands of the Commission, in the hands of Borough of Alder, and indeed a lot of the trade and other things. And the idea was to put them all together. But in fact, just as they come together at EU level, and theoretically they're all in the hands of Ashton, in practice, member states have much more of a say in foreign policy, as Carol was saying at the beginning, but also within member states, they're much more divided. So this is really a very big issue. Lisbon also should logically have led to more consistency between internal and external policies within the Union in areas like human rights and democracy. For example, Viviana Reding, when she came in as the Justice Commissioner, said she was going to do fundamental rights impact assessments on every EU policy, including external policies. And we thought, yay, this is great, the EU actually has to produce an impact assessment of whether selling arms, not that that would be my mistake, but yeah, to a particular country or signing an association agreement is going to have an impact on fundamental rights. Okay, this has disappeared, this has vanished off the agenda. But also, unfortunately, we've seen a disconnect of the EAS from some of the Commission officials who are dealing with these issues in DG Justice, DG Home. So, and of course, there's been a nasty coincidence with the harshening of the political climate on issues like migrants' rights. We look at the response to the refugees who arrived in Lampedusa from Tunisia as a result of the Libya crisis. So it's just so much harder now for foreign policy issues to get a hearing amongst all the other things that are going on. So the one bright spot that I'll finish with is the impact of the Arab Spring, because that really did upset the apple cart, and it's been very helpful for big tech. Because lots of EU member states, particularly individual ministers, ended up with egg all over their faces. It just was really embarrassing to discover that after when the popular result rolls started, just how much they were in bed with the regimes, how much they were, you know, going on Nile cruises with Mubarak or holidays in Tunisia with Ben Ali, etc. So that actually was a very useful moment in which to say, look, there are consequences to these inconsistencies. And member states undermining the overall EU lines by having cosy relationships with regimes that don't support the common EU approach has consequences. It really matters. It's going to be so much harder to rebuild relationships. that was a beautiful moment for I told you so. We tried to use that to the hilt. But I think the real challenge now with the Arab revolutions and the transitions now is to put the instruments together in an effective way and make the conditionality work. And Karen's done a lot of work on conditionality and is one of the few academics who's actually sat down and gone through how often and when and how the EU has actually used its conditionality in the various agreements and instruments it has. And the answer is not very often. In fact, I think probably you can count on the fingers of one hand how often it's happened with countries. Enlargement is the big conditionality-led relationship, but that's a different thing because then you're becoming part of the EU. But in with the countries. Now you've got Ashton, who's come out with this more for more policy. Exactly what that means we have yet to see, but it's an attempt to have a kind of positive conditionality and an attempt to bring the instruments together in a way that didn't really happen in the Barcelona process. So that's going to be the big challenge. Can the EU deliver what it's promised? And will that be what these countries really want? And can the External Action Service continue to keep the member states engaged and interested in the southern rim of the Mediterranean? Or is there a risk that, in fact, concerns about migration, concerns about austerity, about budget cuts, the concerns about trade and so on will override them? So I think the Arab transitions are a really big test for the EU. There have been many, many parallels with 1989 and 1991 and so on that people have made. I think the most important parallel is actually with the Balkans emerging from conflict. Will the EU be able to do a better job with the Arab transitions? We have yet to see.
Great, thanks very much. Right, now we'll open it up for questions from the audience. I think what I might do is group them, if that's okay.
Thank you. My name's Mike Harvey from Open University. I've got one comment and a couple of very questions. I think the first thing that sort of comes across to me is that there's challenges for matrix management with Lisbon and everything being divided and member states' particular cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a critical one. Only other management consultants don't get hold of it, but I suspect they should all make an even bigger bugger's mother. Right, okay, next thing. Is the lack of leadership, which was the point made by the first speaker, and all speakers, thank you very much, it's very illuminating. Is the lack of leadership and ownership inevitable? For instance, we've got a weak president of the European Council, we've got a very strong president of the Commission, we've got the representative for foreign affairs when the jury is out, and I thank Heather for actually pointing out the size of the job and too much was actually thrown at that job for one particular person who in fact had certainly got limited abilities, but you know, let's face it, lots of us got limited abilities. I think the question really about the lack of leadership and ownership is there's no Whiffen factor, there's no radio Whiffen. What's in it for me? When there was a president for 6 months, he wouldn't glorify himself. Blair had his Africa thing, others had that, and I think this is one of the problems with the structure. You do need a figure who can drive something forward for it in a period of time. You've mentioned the Arab Spring, but the elephant is still in the room. And the EU has been completely ineffectual and has actually followed the United States. Bush insisted on democratic elections in Palestine. Hamas were democratically elected. The European Union followed the directive of Israel and the United States by cutting off funding to the Palestinian Authority. That is not democratic. I know there are issues because Germany will always follow Israel. The Holocaust did happen, we recognise the Holocaust happened, but the Holocaust is now 50 or 60 years ago. And the greatest proponents of ethnic cleansing in this country, in the world, appear to be Israel at the moment. What are the NGOs doing now, timely-wise, to prepare for the next Palestinian elections to ensure that whoever is elected is recognised in negotiations? From the human rights point of view, what is being done to support the Palestinians whose land is being taken away from them in the settlements of the West Bank? We've got somebody propounding to be American president who reckons that everybody who lives on the West Bank has to be Israeli and Jewish. What is the European Union doing here? Or if you just skip up the ghost, and the other question, I'm not aware, but is there a European APAC which is keeping everything under the surface?
Any other questions that want to anyone else? This is quite key to address here, but I think the lack of leadership is one that you could all. I personally did have conversations with people indicating that there was going to be a cost to getting rid of the presidency. Mm-hmm. I think that the loss of the presidency is also a loss of a connection between the EU and the member state level, which could therefore diminish the desire of member states to participate wholeheartedly in it. But I think I've heard from all of you quite different perspectives on what the loss of the presidency is meaning. But if we don't have that, where is the leadership come from?
Well, just a couple of points on that. The presidency was a problem, actually, because shifting the priorities every 6 months was difficult. Member states that don't really have that much of a foreign policy couldn't lead very effectively. So I think it wasn't bad having a kind of permanent chair of the Foreign Affairs Council. That's actually a good thing. Where the presidency really mattered is in something that most people outside the system don't know about, which is the multilateral delegations. Because the presidency actually provided resources to, for example, on the UN or in Geneva, in New York and in Geneva and so on, by providing its own diplomats. Now, that was quite a stretch when it came to, say, Slovenia, which doesn't really have so many diplomats to spare. But the presidency had somebody, a foreign minister, who could simply go to lots more of the meetings. And that's one of the reasons why Ashton's had so much difficulty. She simply cannot be present at three places at once. Her diary, from the beginning of the year, 300 days of it are already booked with essential meetings at which the EU must be represented, and she's the one. Whereas in the past, you could divide that up among the presidency, foreign minister, and indeed others. And I think this problem of lack of political deputies is one of the biggest issues in the current setup. So the British presidency, yes, you've lost something, but it also didn't work that brilliantly either. But I would just also look at the other questions of leadership and presidencies. I don't agree that the European Council has a weak president. I think the European Council has exactly the kind of president that the member states wanted, which is why they appointed him. They didn't want a Blair striding out and telling them what to do. They wanted somebody who would try and fix the deals. And in fact, I think Van Rompuy is very good at that. He has managed to fix the deals on the key issues, which are actually not in Brussels at the moment. They're on the euro. And he's behind the scenes, you know, he allows Merkozy to go out and take the credit, which is exactly what they wanted. But he has, in fact, done an insidious job of, you know, behind the scenes getting the member states to work together and brokering the compromises. I also wouldn't agree with the statement that the Commission President is particularly strong at the moment, even though it's his second term. The Commission is really fighting for its political life now. The Commission is weaker than I've ever seen it right now. And on foreign policy, it's especially difficult because, you know, Ashton is a vice president of the Commission, but she's still got the Commission President, and yet she also has the mandate from the member states. It's a very awkward situation. So there's a lack of one strong leader who says, this is what the EU is going to do. You know, there's no Barack Obama equivalent, but that's because the system has been specifically designed to avoid that. And if I could just quote off the record a conversation I had with Solana. I can remember Solana at one point commenting that a very important part of his job was getting member states on board. That's a really key part of the job because they have never asked for somebody to come and tell them what their policy is. Instead, the job is to try to forge a policy from all the very many different interest perspectives, and the fact that on a number of issues, there are quite a lot of member states that don't really have a clear position. So the lack of leadership is intrinsic to the system, and what you have to do is organise the system around that, and that's what is still the real problem with the expansion system.
Yeah,
maybe
the lack of leadership, but also think that what should be stressed is that it's true in a way that there is a lack of leadership, which is, as I said, in the system itself, which is also due to the fact that the External Action Service is a merging of the Commission, the Council Secretariat, and the DPRs. People working and being loyal to previous institutions and with working methods which are different among each other. So there is a learning process that still needs to be done in terms of how to prepare documents and how to relate with member states. I also think that the creation of the permanent chair of the Political and Security Committee, as well as the geographical working group, is something that should be exploited further. Because in a way it's a bridge between the member states and the External Action Service, and it should be used as testing what are possible scenarios, what is possible policy option developed by the External Action Service with the member states before they become documents for member states discussion. I also want to stress that now that we don't have the 6 months rotating presidency chain, the various working group, we also have a loss in terms of human resources because every country that was open the presidency was bringing extra staff in Brussels, and this is not the case anymore. And this is another factor that needs to be taken into consideration. And maybe which is not an answer to your question, but it's just in relation to what Heather said before about the euro crisis. I think that the euro crisis is really a crucial element which explains why foreign policy issues are not on the top of the agenda of the EU at the moment. But I also think it's a crisis that if the EU manages to survive it, it has to do it through political thinking and through political decisions, which means what is the way ahead of the European project. teachers needs, what do they want to do in foreign policy. And linked to that, and linked to the leadership issue, there is also the decision-making procedure. Lisbon has not changed the unanimity rule. So whatever is this super job that Ashton has to do, or whatever, and even though she is a vice president of the commission, she is high representative, she has to merge the two institutions, and she has to facilitate consensus among member states. She also has the right of initiative in foreign policy, which was not the case with Solana. Still, she needs to have the buy-in of 27 member states. And so the unanimity rule is still there, and obviously it works as a very strong constraint on any kind of leader Ashton wants.
Catherine?
Well, come in. I'm going to sound, first of all, like those management consultants that you just criticised, because I think we need to draw a distinction between leadership and management. I think that some of the criticism of Ashton has been unfair on this leadership question, because there are those who wanted a sort of pompous leader striding around the world. And if you look, for instance, at the coverage in Le Monde, I mean, I found it completely hysterical and absurd, because she's not that figure. And from our side, that's not necessarily what the service needed. And also that's not necessarily the kind of leadership that is effective in the world for anybody. And if I may say so, it's a particular male type of leadership. So some of that's problematic, but where we have seen an issue is in her management of the service. And I would say one of the key problems has been the inability to build alliances with key people within the service that she's managing, but also with other institutions and other political actors. And here we come back to the member states. The fact that so many member states are so frustrated with her, I think, is because she hasn't been able to build those alliances. And in order to get anything done in EU policy making, whatever issue you're working on, you need to build alliances. And she just doesn't seem to care. And from the member states, again, there's been some unreasonable criticism, but a lot of reasonable criticism. And I do think most of the member states genuinely wanted this to succeed, with the notable exception of this member state, clearly. But for most of the others, I don't think those conspiracies that they're secretly happy that there's this catastrophe, I don't think that really is a reasonable discussion. Certainly there were problems with the presidency, and of course it depended. I mean, if we look at the subject of our discussion, the relationship with NGOs, I mean, I can tell you the great sense of relief when the Swedish presidency came in following the Czech presidency. The kind of working relationship that we could have varied so hugely. And I think the question is just what replaces the presidency? It's not to look nostalgically at what the presidency system was, because it was flawed in many ways. However, there needs to be the provision of strategy, policy, direction, guidance, and the alliance building to get things, the smart alliance building to get things done. And this is what seems to be lacking now, but may follow. I won't answer your question about Israel-Palestine, but just to say that a lot of NGOs are working on this issue very much, and with sort of multi-level advocacy strategies targeting Brussels and the member states. It's not so much Germany that's necessarily the issue anymore. There's a number of other member states. And I think there we see a problem in the EU that a lot of its actions focused on technical questions without addressing the big political questions and the big justice questions. And on the big political issues, it remains wedded to support for the peace process, which many people in the region would not consider a neutral stance. Just to say a word about the euro crisis, as Heather mentioned, I mean, in the long term, this may have a positive impact. I mean, right now, there is a lack of emphasis on foreign policy, and I think this is detracted a lot of attention, but it may, over the longer term, contribute to member states becoming more united behind the EU simply because of resource constraints. So I think there's ways that it could play out positively for EU external affairs.
Great, thanks. We have time for one very quick question. Now everybody's in.
Charlie Brown from the Asahi Shimbun Japanese Daily. I'm just wondering, are there ever any times when NGOs work, or have to work, creative, well, even more creatively than you do normally, and work with, in a very indirect and roundabout way, with external actors? I'm thinking of the obvious one with the US, mm-hmm. or say Japan, to sort of influence either subtly or very openly EU foreign policy.
Okay, my quick question is, how does lack of internal coordination is affecting EU's on the ground, so the effectiveness of EU policy on the ground?
I can give you a quick answer on the US. Because I work for the Open Society Foundations, which also has a DC advocacy office, quite often what we'll do is, I shouldn't say this on the record because it's a very sneaky trick, but we'll persuade the State Department, persuade Hillary Clinton to issue a statement on X or Y country or issue, and then we'll go to the EU and you say, do you know Hillary Clinton is about to issue a statement? Don't you think you should get your statement out first? Sometimes. Yeah, they do. And the other thing is just to coordinate, just to say, look, you know, this is how the US is going to approach this issue. Isn't it helpful? And start a conversation. Just do a bit of back channel, really. Absolutely, it can be quite a helpful way of acting.
The same for us. We have an advocacy office in Washington. We have an advocacy office in New York. We also do advocacy in Moscow in Beijing. Especially with the advocacy team in Washington and New York, we coordinate on policy line and on some specific country. We might have like recommendation to both the EU and the US or the UN, which they reinforce each other.
Yes, I mean similarly, I think there's a lot of strategies that can be used. I mean, we were referring to the US last year when it looked like with the QDDR that there was a shift in US foreign policy towards conflict prevention, which hasn't really gone anywhere. But when that happened, we used it to try and then sort of put pressure on the EU to develop, stimulating a bit of competition. And including, for instance, hosting a meeting with senior US policy makers who would then talk about their developments. We would invite the people responsible for conflict prevention at USAID, at the State Department, and then have that discussion. There's also non-member states that can be used. I mean, on air issue, Norway, Switzerland, Canada, that have quite strong missions, presence in Brussels, and who share an interest often in making the EU more effective, because its lack of effectiveness affects what they do in different third countries, as well as the fact they might, for instance, second people to EU 60p missions. I mean, the other external actors we would use, although I shouldn't say that, is it NGO people from different countries and different regions, for instance. This week we have a meeting on Boko Haram and the situation in northern Nigeria. So there we bring in people, analysts, activists from that region, because to talk directly to EU policymakers, because it's far more influential for them to do that than for me to do that. The lack of internal coordination question, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, again, on our issue on conflict, this was a problem pre-Lisbon, of course, absolutely. If you took Georgia, for instance, where you'd have the EU active in a number of different ways. I mean, CSDP mission, a delegation, two special representatives whose mandate covered Georgia, plus you've got development assistance, plus you've got trade relations, and no sort of sense of coordination. The situation is improving to some extent, but I think there are still major problems. And there you have the third country being able to exploit the differences and the lack of communication between the different EU actors So, for instance, for something like conditionality ever to work, there has to be a unified EU stance rather than manipulation by, I mean, let's mention Georgia, but Saakashvili is a smart enough political operator to exploit those kind of differences, as many leaders are as well. And also, it just simply looks embarrassing, it's a waste of resources. But that's at EU level. If you then factor in 10, 15 or 20 member state embassies, consulates, etc., it's clearly not a satisfactory situation. But again, if you look at impact, if we look at something like the World Development Report from last year, which shows very clearly that coordination and cooperation in conflict-affected countries by all international actors is essential for having an impact in fragile states. And then you've got Europe itself with this proliferation of actors. I think it also, for a final point, because I'm going off on a tangent, but I think this sometimes is about different European actors not understanding how little power they now have in the world. You know, last year I was in Nepal. I mean, Europe is so irrelevant to Nepal. Why do you then still have a number of different EU actors and EU member states? Surely some sort of collective action would at least allow the EU to have some leverage and make some positive difference. But so many member states operating with a sort of post-colonial complex that they still have power, and then the EU becoming, overcoming its fragmentation. So.
Anyway, I'd just like to thank all three of you very much. I learned quite a bit about influencing EU foreign policy, very grateful to you all for coming all the way over from Brussels. It's rare that we get things from the trash people from Brussels so coming all the way over, and we hope to see you again soon at the NEC. We'll welcome back soon. Anyway, thank you very much.